Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Doug Sovereign, political reporter at KCBS Radio in San Francisco, your moderator for the program. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org or download our iPhone or Android app for program and schedule information and podcasts of past programs. You can find me on Twitter at Sovereign Nation. It is now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, George Packer. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker and author of the new book, The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. George Packer was born right here in the Bay Area in Santa Clara, raised in Palo Alto, a child of Silicon Valley before it was called that. He went to Yale, served in the Peace Corps in Togo, then he became a journalist and author. He's written for the New York Times Magazine, Dissent, Mother Jones, Harper's, became a staff writer at the New Yorker 10 years ago. He's written two novels, five books of nonfiction, and an award-winning off-Broadway play. He covered the Iraq War for the New Yorker. He wrote the acclaimed book, The Assassin's Gate, about that conflict. He's reported from Africa, the Middle East, and all over America. He was chosen as a Guggenheim Fellow in 2001. He has taught at Harvard, Bennington, and Columbia. Even though he's from the Bay Area, he engaged in some reverse migration. He now lives in Brooklyn. Please don't hold that against him as we welcome George Packer.
Thanks, Doug. I was last here, I think, when The Assassin's Gate came out, so it's wonderful to be back at the Commonwealth Club, and a special welcome to my extended family here in the front rows. When I'm asked where did this book come from, in a way the answer is it came from Iraq, oddly enough, even though this is a book very much focused on America. When I was covering Iraq and the war for the New Yorker, my initial sense of why everything was imploding there was to blame individual leaders, and we know who they are. And they were to blame. There were gross failures on the part of almost everyone in the highest positions of responsibility. But over time, Iraq came to seem more and more like a failure of American institutions. No matter how much money and how much effort and even how much talent and goodwill we threw at that country, it all seemed to avail nothing. And that was partly because it was an impossible job, but also because the institutions that were responsible, from highest government agencies to the military, from the intelligence community to the media, that were all there in one capacity or another, the nonprofit world, the for-profit world, they just didn't have whatever had allowed us to rebuild Europe after World War II. Something had been lost in recent years, and I wondered, when did that happen? Why did that happen? And then I came back from Iraq in time to cover the 2008 presidential election, and suddenly institutions were collapsing everywhere you looked. Wall Street banks, lending institutions across the country, General Motors, Chrysler. It was an epic sense, a sort of apocalyptic sense almost, that the pillars that had upheld the post-war order in America, that had created the most successful middle-class democracy in history, seemed to be coming undone. And that struck me as being a very, very big story, a story well worth telling. But the question was, how do you tell a story like that? There are a lot of books out there, very good ones, about the decline of the middle class, about income inequality, about the collapse of our old media institutions, about political polarization in Washington, about the rise of big money and corporate power on Capitol Hill. I didn't have anything to add to those books. I didn't want to write another What's Wrong with America and How to Fix It book. I actually don't know how to fix it. So when you ask me that afterward, I'm going to have to admit to you that I don't have the answers. But I thought what I could add to this growing sense that something has come undone is a narrative, is a book that gives you a picture of the country the way a big novel would give you a picture of the country, through the stories of individuals, which is, for me, the way I approach the world, the way I understand the world, and the way I think about how to describe the world. So I began to go around the country and find those individuals and find those stories that could tell this larger story of what I think of as the end of a deal that used to exist among Americans, a deal that said, if you do your part and work hard, there's a place for you and maybe even better place for your children. The dream of upward mobility across generations and of equal opportunity for all. And what we've seen over the past generation, which is the period covered by the unwinding, a period of about three decades, is the fraying of our social contract. Until now, I think it can hardly be said to exist any longer, and its replacement by something else. Again, a big, ambitious subject. Big subjects are best illuminated, I think, by small dramas. So I've tried to find those dramas, and I'm going to read you the prologue to give you a sense of the lay of the land of the book and of the writing in the book, and then talk a little more about it. No one can say when the unwinding began, when the coil that held Americans together in its secure and sometimes stifling grip first gave way. Like any great change, the unwinding began at countless times, in countless ways, and at some moment, the country, always the same country, crossed a line of history and became irretrievably different. If you were born around 1960 or afterward, you've spent your adult life in the vertigo of that unwinding. You watched structures that had been in place before your birth collapse like pillars of salt across the vast visible landscape. The farms of the Carolina Piedmont, the factories of the Mahoning Valley, Florida subdivisions, California schools, and other things harder to see, but no less vital in supporting the order of everyday life, changed beyond recognition. Ways and means in Washington caucus rooms, taboos on New York trading desks, manners and morals everywhere. When the norms that made the old institutions useful began to unwind and the leaders abandoned their posts, the Roosevelt Republic that had reigned for almost half a century came undone. The void was filled by the default force in American life, organized money. The unwinding is nothing new. There have been unwindings every generation or two. The fall to earth of the founders' heavenly republic in a noisy marketplace of quarrelsome factions. The war that tore the United States apart and turned them from plural to singular. The crash that laid waste to the business of America, making way for a democracy of bureaucrats and everymen. Each decline brought renewal. Each implosion released energy. Out of each unwinding came a new cohesion. The unwinding brings freedom more than the world has ever granted and to more kinds of people than ever before. Freedom to go away, freedom to return, freedom to change your story, get your facts, get hired, get fired, get high, marry, divorce, go broke, begin again, start a business, have it both ways, take it to the limit, walk away from the ruins, succeed beyond your dreams and boast about it, fail abjectly, and try again. And with freedom, the unwinding brings its illusions, for all these pursuits are as fragile as thought balloons popping against circumstances. Winning and losing are all American games, and in the unwinding, winners win bigger than ever, floating away like bloated dirigibles. And losers have a long way to fall before they hit bottom, and sometimes they never do. This much freedom leaves you on your own. More Americans than ever before live alone, but even a family can exist in isolation, just managing to survive in the shadow of a huge military base without a soul to lend a hand. A shiny new community can spring up overnight, miles from anywhere, and then fade away just as fast. An old city can lose its industrial foundation and two-thirds of its people, while all its mainstays, churches, government, businesses, charities, unions, fall like building flats in a strong wind, hardly making a sound. Alone on a landscape without solid structures, Americans have to improvise their own destinies, plot their own stories of success and salvation. A North Carolina boy, clutching a Bible in the sunlight, grows up to receive a new vision of how the countryside could be resurrected. A young man goes to Washington and spends the rest of his career trying to recall the idea that drew him there in the first place. An Ohio girl has to hold her life together as everything around her falls apart, until in middle age she finally seizes the chance to do more than just survive. As these obscure Americans find their way in the unwinding, they pass alongside new monuments where the old institutions once stood, the outsized lives of their most famous countrymen, celebrities who only grow more exalted as other things recede. These icons sometimes occupy the personal place of household gods, and they offer themselves as answers to the riddle of how to live a good or better life. In the unwinding, everything changes and nothing lasts, except for the voices, American voices, open, sentimental, angry, matter of fact, inflected with borrowed ideas, God, TV, and the dimly remembered past, telling a joke above the noise of the assembly line, complaining behind window shades drawn against the world, thundering justice to a crowded park or an empty chamber, closing a deal on the phone, dreaming aloud late at night on a front porch as trucks rush by in the darkness. So these two pages give you a map of the whole book. I've just introduced all the characters and the themes of the book in that little overture. The Ohio girl is a woman named Tammy Thomas, who grew up in Youngstown, Ohio, when it was Steel Town, and watched the steel mills disappear almost overnight, replaced by nothing, a complete void that led to a kind of collapse of the city that was even faster and more breathtaking than Detroit. And in this absence of the mainstays of life, she had to raise three kids on her own and did it by getting one of the last good factory jobs in an auto parts plant. And then that was shipped overseas in the way of so many manufacturing jobs in the Rust Belt. And in midlife, faced with the need to continue to survive, she remade herself as a community organizer just in time for the election of Barack Obama in 2008. The Washington guy is a political operative named Jeff Conaton, who attached his aspirations and his ambitions to Joe Biden and worked for Biden for years and gradually became disillusioned with Biden and also to some extent with government, became a lobbyist, which is what just about everyone who goes to Washington ends up being, made a fortune as a lobbyist, and then lost half of it in the financial crisis of 2008, which is like the watershed event for every character in the book. The whole book moves you toward this precipice of 2008. And in the face of that, he re-entered government as the chief of staff to Biden's successor, Ted Kaufman, with the single aim of making Wall Street pay and imposing some discipline on the banks and bringing the wrongdoers whose fraud led to the financial crisis to justice, which of course none of which happened, but it was for him a kind of matter of self-respect to recognize that he had been part of a corrupt system and he wanted to try to make it good. The book also has profiles of a number of well-known American celebrities, from Newt Gingrich in politics to Oprah Winfrey in entertainment, Robert Rubin in finance, Alice Waters in food. They represent sort of the elites in our culture, many of whom came from the same really obscure backgrounds as these main characters that I'm describing. In most cases, they either were rising up through institutions that no longer were working as they should, like Colin Powell in government and Robert Rubin on Wall Street, and didn't understand until it was too late that they were a part of the problem and that their institutions were actually working directly to undermine the ambitions that they thought that they had. Others of the celebrities are more institution breakers, and I think that's kind of the role that elites play today. They got where they were by breaking the rules. Facebook's slogan is move fast and break things. Jay-Z is one of the subjects of the book. His whole career from drug dealer to empire builder and to corporate rap star is a story of don't wait in line. Don't simply hold down a job and finish school, because that's a sucker's game. The way to make it is the way the mafia lords made it, which is to be tough and to want to win, and winning is its own justification. The North Carolina boy clutching a Bible is a guy named Dean Price, who is the son of a fire and brimstone preacher in the Bible Belt of rural North Carolina. His family farmed tobacco for generations. And he grew up with the ambition to be an entrepreneur. His heroes were people like Andrew Carnegie and Henry Ford, older Americans. He has a deep rootedness in our history, which is very evident when you travel to the Piedmont region of the Carolinas. But he created a chain of truck stops on a stretch of a highway between North Carolina and Virginia with fast food restaurants. But all the while, the countryside around him was collapsing. Walmart and multinational oil companies were making it almost impossible for him to compete. And meanwhile, tobacco was dying as an industry, and so was textiles, the other mainstay of life. And by the time he tried to make a go of it as an entrepreneur, the rural South was beginning to look a lot like the core of our cities, with rampant drug abuse and multiple generations on public assistance, unemployment, and a kind of despair settling in. Dean Price, like all the characters in the book, had a vision of how he could resuscitate the collapsing order around him. And he had a sort of series of epiphanies. Being a man from a religious area, although he turned against and rebelled against his father's harsher Christianity, he remained a spiritual man, and his vision was of a kind of revival of the countryside through what was right at hand, which is to say crops like canola and waste oil from all the fast food joints in North Carolina, which is to say biodiesel. He wanted to become a biodiesel entrepreneur, and that it continues to be his ambition today. I'm going to read you a little passage from the middle of the book that catches Dean just at the cusp of this transition from truck stop entrepreneur to Johnny Appleseed of biofuels. But you can see that I had a tremendous amount of material covering the vastness of the country. Silicon Valley is in the book, Wall Street is in the book, Washington, the power centers. But so are these forgotten and left behind places, like the Rust Belt, like the rural South, like the exurbs of Tampa Bay after the housing bust. And I had to create a structure that could tell these stories in the manner of a big novel. And the structure takes you through 30 years of American history, but it's not big history. It's not the big events of the past generation. It's this inner history of their lives, which are always being pushed and acted upon by what's happening in places like Wall Street and Washington. So it's history from the ground up, but always under the influence of these larger forces that are gradually undoing the contract that held America together and that these characters all grew up with. So I'll end with this passage from the middle of the book, which comes just before the financial crisis, which is a reckoning for both Dean Price, because that's when his truck stop business fails, and for all the other characters in the book.
A two-lane asphalt road ran past the woods, white oak, shagbark hickory, Carolina ash, and in the shadows of the trees, a tobacco barn was year by year collapsing on itself, the metal roof sloping inward, pieces of bare siding hanging loose from nails. Nearby, a white clapboard house with empty windows squatted at the roadside, half smothered in tree branches and vines, while a fire-scorched, handwritten sign on the outside wall still advertised crush. Farther along, the road took a turn, and a tidy brick ranch house with a big satellite dish mounted on top stood in the golden sunlight of a red-brown field. Another bend, a gentle hill, deep woods again, then an abandoned metal warehouse alone in a clearing. The road straightened and flattened and came to a stoplight where a pair of strip malls faced each other, parking lots full, a Walgreens across from a McDonald's, Shell opposing BP. Another light, a shuttered car dealership, a vast scrapyard with a mountain of twisted metal and stacked timbers, next door to a spinning mill that was being methodically gutted like a great whale and sold off one part at a time. And then downtown, the lonely little main street, a Taekwondo studio, a government benefits office, a closed restaurant, a nameless corner store for rent, two pedestrians in four blocks, a Dollar General that marked the far end of town. On the other side, the country opened up at once, the road passing fields, corn planted on one, nothing on the next, weeds, clods of dirt, and then a residential development with two-story look-alike houses in neat rows laid out across someone's former tobacco farm. And beyond the subdivision, isolated on acres of grass behind a split-rail fence and a man-made lake, the supersized faux chateau of a celebrity NASCAR driver. The landscape Dean had returned to, where he planned to live out his life, was very old and also new, as particular as anything in America, and also as generic, as beautiful and as ugly. In his imagination, it had become a nightmare, so profoundly wrong that he called it sinful, and he hated the sin more than any casual visitor or distant critic possibly could. Yet he also saw here a dream of redemption so unlikely and glorious that it could only fill the mind's eye of a visionary native son. Once driving through Cleveland County, Dean happened to pass the hard-shell Baptist church that his father had once tried to get and failed, the failure that had broken his father's will. Dean had gone down with him to Cleveland County and heard the sermon that his father had given for his audition back around 1975, so that decades later, he recognized the church. And he also noticed that there was now a fucking Bojangles right next door. For Dean, Bojangles had come to represent everything that was wrong with the way Americans lived, how they raised their food and transported it across the country, how they grew the crops to feed the animals they ate, the way they employed the people who worked in the restaurants, the way the money left the community. Everything about it was wrong. Dean's own business, gas and fast food, had become hateful to him, and he saw the error of his ways as his father never had. And the conjunction of his father's legacy and his own struck him with bitter irony as he drove past. He was seeing beyond the surfaces of the land to its hidden truths. Some nights, he sat up late on his front porch with a glass of Jack and listened to the trucks heading south on 220, carrying crates of live chickens to the slaughterhouses, always under cover of darkness, like a vast and shameful trafficking. Chickens pumped full of hormones that left them too big to walk. And he thought how these same chickens might return from their destination as pieces of meat to his floodlit Bojangles up the hill from his house. And that meat would be drowned in the bubbling fryers by employees whose hatred of the job would leak into the cooked food. And that food would be served up and eaten by customers who would grow obese and end up in the hospital in Greensboro with diabetes or heart failure, a burden to the public. And later, Dean would see them riding around the Mayodan Walmart in electric carts because they were too heavy to walk the aisles of a supercenter, just like hormone-fed chickens. So that's Dean Price's nightmare vision of one of the most beautiful parts of the country. And it's his quest, which is both self-interested because he wants to make his fortune, and also a sign of deep commitment both to his neck of the woods and really to an idea of America that he still holds, to revive it with what he calls this new green economy. He calls it that in all innocence, as if no one had ever used that phrase, because no one told him about it. He didn't have an organization behind him, a newspaper, a business association, or a community college. And that's true of all the characters in the book. They are on their own figuring things out for themselves. And what Dean figures out is that if he can get canola or waste oil made biodiesel into every school bus in every county in North Carolina, the entire state will be revived, will be like Silicon Valley. That's how he used to talk about it. He saw himself, and I say this, you know, in all respect for Dean, as a kind of Steve Jobs of biodiesel. And that's still what he's doing today. So there's, in each of these stories, Dean, Tammy Thomas, Jeff Connaughton, they all make mistakes. They screw up in big ways. They go bankrupt. They make stupid investments. Their marriages break up. They have too many children without a father to support them. They get involved in dirty businesses. But they never let go of the idea that there is something more important than simply surviving, and that America still stands for that something. The question is whether their investment in the American dream is reciprocated. Is the American dream still invested in people like them? So the book takes you through their stories and others while moving between power centers and backwaters, celebrities and obscure people, as this period of the unwinding moves from the past, the late 70s, and until the moment we're living in now. And that is what I tried to do in writing this book. Thank you.
Our thanks to George Packer, staff writer for The New Yorker, author of the book The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. All right, time for our question period. We have a lot of questions here. People have a lot to ask you. A few things. And who needs the whole book? You just summed up all the problems of America in one paragraph.
No, you need
fried
the whole
chicken.
Book. You need it.
That was it.
It's not just about chicken.
A few people want to know, and I count myself among them, just about the writing of this book. How long did it take? How did you pick these people? How did you find the people who you profiled?
Yeah, this book was unlike anything I've written. It took about 3 years, 2 years of reporting, and then 9 months in which the reporting kind of continued because I really hadn't finished, but I knew I had to start writing, and the writing was a sprint, and I'm still exhausted from it. I didn't have a master plan. This was the terrifying thing. I had instincts, like, who is an interesting person? Well, 30 seconds on the phone with Dean Price, and I told him, stop talking, I'm coming down, don't waste it on the phone. Little did I know, I heard the same story 100 times from him, and he was always exciting. It always sounded like he was telling it for the first time, his epiphany about biodiesel. Dean Price let me into his world. I stayed at his house. I went down there 6 or 8 times, and he let me drive around North Carolina on his lonely quest, and it was just riveting to see this one man sort of up against the multinationals, the big box stores, the indifference of bureaucrats, the poverty of the region, the skepticism of his own mother, and he just kept at it in this, I think, quintessentially American way. So that was an easy one. Of course I wanted to tell his story, and it fit so well with this larger theme. Jeff Connaughton, the Washington operative, I met while working on a New Yorker piece about insider trading. He was a source for me. And he mentioned that he had been a longtime Washington insider who ended up as a lobbyist. And it just suddenly seemed, yeah, I need the Washington part of this story. and he's the vehicle for it. I was always looking for the character who would allow me to tell the story in intimate terms. I did not want to tell the big story of how money took over in Washington. We've heard it, and the thought of having to assemble all the research and data just to do it again seemed pointless. But to tell it through one man's life, that kind of excited my literary instincts. And then Tammy Thomas, I actually went out to find. I wanted to find a woman in the Rust Belt who was doing something to try to turn around her community.
So you found these people, you visited them again and again, you seems like you spoke with their families and friends and did a lot of on-the-ground reporting.
It just immersion journalism.
And
yeah.
Then when you approach, I mean, when you read this book, it really reads more like a novel. As you mentioned, it's literary nonfiction. Can you talk a little bit about the approach you took to putting it all together and writing it in that way as opposed to a more polemic, dry,
right,
academic book?
Well, the biggest decision I made was to get rid of the first person. So you will not find I, that is referring to me, anywhere in the book. I even tried to get rid of it in the acknowledgments, but it was very awkward, so I had to put it in. The decision to get rid of I meant that I had to tell the entire story through characters. There was going to be no direct commenting, explaining, arguing, bringing in my own experience, which are the tools I've always used in the past. And that put me much closer to the terrain of a novel in the third person, but with a lot of points of view.
Mm-hmm.
How to structure it was the moment of panic. I had done 2 years of hard work and had no idea how all this could hang together and was really in a sort of a state of crisis about it. And then my wife reminded me that at the start of the process, I'd actually come up with a structure, which I then got rid of because I assumed it would never work. And she reminded me it was to use the great trilogy of John Dos Passos, USA, which is about the first three decades of the 20th century in America, and which moves from his ordinary protagonists to portraits of Woodrow Wilson and John D. Rockefeller and J.P. Morgan and Isadora Duncan. And through these kind of mishmashes of headlines and songs of different moments along the way. And I didn't think I could do that because I didn't think I had the whole story of these people that would allow me to go through 30 or 35 years of their lives. When I started to write, I realized I got a lot from them. Spending weeks with people, you just pick things up along the way in odd moments. And that became the structure to move through American history in these parallel tracks from different parts of the country and to cut back and forth, which means really having to make careful decisions about how to sequence them. How long can I leave Dean Price after introducing him before the reader's going to forget about him? How much patience can I count on? And it does demand a little bit of patience.
So. It is really reminiscent. If anyone has read John Dos Passos, when you read this book, you'll see it does echo that. You say in the book that an unwinding is not necessarily a bad thing, and we've undergone them many times. So is this one, do you come to a conclusion in this book as to whether the unwinding is necessarily making America a worse place, or in some ways is the country better?
I think it's moved in two directions at once. We have greater freedom than we've ever had, more choices, more apps, and more people who can use them. I mean, the circle of inclusion has widened. You can now be a gay Boy Scout, which you could not when I was a kid. That's a good thing. But that gay Boy Scout probably goes to a crappy public school. And at the same time that we've had this widening of freedom and of choice, we've had growing disparities between groups of Americans until today we're at a point where it makes the period of the Great Gatsby seem relatively egalitarian. We have a class of celebrities that are like a superclass unto themselves. They marry each other, they cheat on each other, they sit on each other's boards, they support each other's causes, they blurb each other's books. They're living like Olympic gods, and their countrymen are sort of left at the bottom of the mountain to watch them in awe. And that is sort of the role that some of the celebrities in my book play.
it's hard to say, you know, is the trade-off worth it? I would say the trade has been freedom. We have more freedom and less security than we did 30 years ago. If equal opportunity really is disappearing as a fact, not as a theoretical possibility, more Americans in theory have opportunity, fewer Americans in fact do. The place you're born, the family you're born into, where you go to school, are really going to determine to a large degree where you end up. And that wasn't true when I was growing up, not nearly as much. To me, that is kind of the end of some crucial part of the American dream, because if without equal opportunity, we become a class society, a stratified society, and I hate seeing that happen. So, I don't know on balance. I do know on balance. I fear for the future that my kids are going to grow up into, because everything is pushing us away from each other. Even the internet is pushing us away from each other. We are connected virtually, but I think physically it actually ghettoizes us. It puts us into niches. Some people think the internet is the answer to everything that I talk about in The Unwinding, that we're going to have a new peer network-based society. And I think peer networks can be useful for things like, you know, Amazon reviews and mm-hmm. Wikipedia and well, Kickstarter, although Wikipedia actually has a few things wrong in my biography. no surprise. Yeah. But I don't think it has the answers to the basic questions of justice and fairness that we face. So I don't have the magic, here's the reform we all need to move to the next era. I'm sure we'll get there. I just don't know what it looks like.
An audience member asks, was there a point or historical moment where government, business, etc., seemed to move away from or even lose its obligation towards a whole and fair society?
You know, you can pinpoint that. I begin the book in 1978. Partly for arbitrary reasons, it's when I graduated from high school. Prop 13 passed in California that year, which I think is a signal event in beginning to dissolve the glue that held together public institutions. Another thing that happened in 78 is that throughout the 70s, with all the economic upheavals of that time, businesses began to feel that they could no longer afford to play ball with government and labor the way they had throughout that post-war era of business-labor cooperation. And they began to spend money on lobbying in Washington in a big way. And there were a few bills that came up in Congress that year. Carter was president. The Democrats controlled both houses. The bills were all defeated, including a labor law reform bill, because business lobbied so heavily against them. And Douglas Frazier, who was the head of the UAW then, quit President Carter's Business Labor Council and wrote a very interesting letter of resignation, which I actually quote in one of these mashups from 1978. He said in his letter, "The leaders of industry, commerce, and finance in the United States have broken and discarded the fragile, unwritten compact previously existing during a past period of growth and progress. Today, we don't even imagine there's ever going to be such a thing as a business labor government council to solve problems of automation and unemployment and things. Everyone is essentially pursuing their interests. There was a time when all of those sectors exercised a certain amount of restraint because they knew that if you push too hard in pursuing your own narrow interests, you might begin to destroy the thing that holds society together. And I think you can look back at the 70s, the late 70s, and say that's when that happened.
You and I are the same age. There's always a tendency to romanticize the past.
Yeah.
Growing up, Vietnam, Watergate, energy crisis, inflation, were those really the good old days? Should we have known those were the halcyon days
of
yore?
You know, I would not want to go back to a time when whole classes of Americans were disenfranchised, when there was no Lipitor, and when, you know, TV, the best show on TV was the Mary Tyler Moore Show. There are a lot of good things about life today. One of them is in my pocket. I'm a slave to it. I bow down before it. It has power. But I don't see why these things could not have coincided with a maintenance of a basic contract among Americans that held the country together, rather than turning everyone into a free agent and an entrepreneur, which is sort of where we are today. Dean Price is a real figure of the present, because to him, it's all about entrepreneurship and making his own way. Except no one ever makes their own way. There's always some government program or scientific research, which of course created Silicon Valley. There's always some bureaucratic structure that creates sort of the boundaries in which people can operate so that no one is able to abuse their power. And I just see those sort of eroding and even collapsing around us. And I don't see why we can't have gay Boy Scouts and good public schools. Why can't we have both?
Are there any institutions that survive or are even gaining strength?
Is the internet an institution? I mean, the internet is a thing we've created. Mm-hmm. It would sort of be like saying, you know, air travel is gaining strength. I don't see them. Maybe they're out there. I mean, I would love to hear from audience members who and others who think I've missed some phenomenon that's happening in America under our noses, but it's too early to see it, which is actually going to replace them. I mean, in my own world of journalism, two things are happening. One is that newspapers and TV news networks are, they're dying. I mean, the LA Times might be owned by the Koch brothers in a few months. you know, there are a few holdouts. Thank God the New Yorker is one of them, and may it continue. But there was a value to having strong independent news organizations that were professional, where there was a level of competence and expertise that was expected. As that dies, we have Twitter, Facebook, social media, which is this powerful tool that more and more people can use. So power is diffuse, and everyone is their own news organization. We have this new thing called citizen journalists, which there's a chapter in the book about Andrew Breitbart, which is ironically called citizen journalist, because anyone can be a citizen journalist, and it's fun. But do we talk about, you know, citizen brain surgeons? To me, it suggests a kind of contempt for what I do, as if anyone can do it. It's not that hard. In fact, better get out of the way and let people, you know, with fresh energy take over. I can't help seeing that as a trade-off that might not be worth it.
The way we always say in our newsroom, this isn't brain surgery, so you can't equate journalists with brain surgery.
It's not brain surgery, but it's not tweeting either.
Exactly. You're listening, I just want to remind for our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our guest is George Packer, staff writer for The New Yorker. He's discussing economic and social shifts that he says are harming the fabric of America, at least in some ways. One of our audience, you mentioned Prop 13, and you grew up in a very good school system and then probably have seen it. Well, that one has remained relatively intact. But
because it's been privatized.
Exactly, that's what I wanted to ask you. There's been talk for years about repealing Prop 13 or modifying Prop 13. It's a difficult thing to approach politically in California. But in some parts of California, essentially the parents have stepped in and filled, right, filled the void left by the lack of property tax. Do you see that changing, or that's creating a really wide gulf?
Well, last year, didn't California pass an initiative to raise taxes for funding public schools?
Yes, the governor's measure Prop 13.
Yeah, and you know, I almost put that into the 2012 mashup, because it seemed like the perfect bookend to 1978 and Prop 13, as if after this long and really misguided foray into low-tax, small government, let a thousand flowers bloom and wilt, we had begun to wake up to the fact that you just can't be a successful society and economy without responsibilities to match your rights. So that may be a sign that, you know, there's a new sobriety and a new maturity about the public. But every time I see it taking a step that way,
I see Apple doing everything it can to avoid paying corporate taxes and still calling itself like a revolutionary lifestyle that thinks different. So I don't see a trend in a single direction. When I began this book, it had a working title of Decline and Renewal. I thought 2008 was a hinge year along the lines of 1932 and 1980, when a whole historical trend was going to move in a new direction with the financial crisis, the election of Obama. And, you know, it's been a disappointment, and I don't put all the blame on the president. I think I keep coming back to the institutions. They are broken, and one even very wise and able man is never going to be able to fix them and to put them to use. So,
there is talk in California of amending Prop 13, at least in terms of how businesses pay their property tax without touching the residential side.
Mm-hmm.
Some of what you said leads me to another question from the audience, which is, what is your take on the fact that many ultra-wealthy prefer personal philanthropy as opposed to more institutional approaches such as paying more tax?
Right, right.
They want to dictate where the money goes.
Right, and that's in the prologue I wrote that in the place of the institutions, we now have celebrities. They have begun to replace institutions. Mark Zuckerberg is there instead of the Newark public school system. Bill Gates is there instead of the public health system. Oprah Winfrey is there instead of a vibrant publishing and book culture. Bless them for being, you know, generous, but when it's personalized that way, it becomes arbitrary and capricious, and it masks self-interests that are always at work. I wrote a piece for The New Yorker a couple weeks ago about the politics of Silicon Valley and came to the startling conclusion that Silicon Valley is another industry with its own interests, which, you know, apparently made some people unhappy in Silicon Valley. I thought it was a pretty obvious truth. I guess not here. So it's a return to what we saw at the start of the century when Dos Passos, the period that Dos Passos wrote about, titans of industry creating universities, libraries, and other great legacies, which no one can object to per se, but which seem like a sign that the public sector is ailing or is absent, and the idea that there's a kind of web that should tie us together that goes way above the personal is sort of fading, so that, you know, when it's a single individual who is, you know, the savior of an institution, it may be, you know, idealistic, but it's not very democratic. It's not accountable.
As someone in his late 20s, I'm curious what would be the main economic differences I would notice if I were to go back in time one generation to say when we were in our 20s.
I think the biggest difference is if you're Dean Price and you're growing up in Rockingham County, North Carolina, and you're not all that interested in school, and you get, you know, your B-minus GPA and your high school degree, there's a job waiting for you at R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Warehouse in Winston-Salem, or at Hanes Underwear. And that job is going to allow you to raise a family. And that no longer exists. So that a whole giant swath of Americans have been left out of whatever new kinds of employment are being created in the economy that has replaced the industrial economy. The two most successful sectors of our country in this period of the unwinding have been Wall Street and Silicon Valley. I like Silicon Valley better than I like Wall Street, but neither one of them is creating jobs that are working or even middle-class jobs in the sense that I grew up understanding those words. Where people who without great educations, without great chances in life,
can just do okay, can do well enough to be part of society. Instead, if you don't have that handhold, you fall, you drop. There's a family in the Tampa, one of the Tampa chapters of the book, who are just drowning. They're all alone. He was a blue-collar worker, lost his job, went to work at Walmart, became a 20-hour-a-week, $8-an-hour produce stocker. There's no way he could support a family on that. And that's what people who used to work at R.J. Reynolds and Haynes are now faced with. I think that would be the most dramatic change that you'd see in the economy.
You could also throw out, you'd be much more likely probably to be able to join a union back then, and it'd be more likely that only one of the parents might be working, as opposed to assuming that both would and must.
And that one job rather than three would be enough to sustain the family. And that you would sort of have a place that was made for you, that you could step into, instead of having to recreate yourself every few years as the creative destruction of capitalism keeps changing the economy. You know, one of the main characters in the book, who I didn't mention earlier, is Peter Thiel, who founded PayPal and became a billionaire through Facebook and lives in San Francisco. He's a libertarian, and he has this... I found him interesting because he moves in two directions at once. He really is a believer in, you know, the forget about the old tired structures. You know, the life is individuals and society is individuals, and you need to rise on your talents. But he also admits that Silicon Valley, the internet, the tech revolution have not raised living standards. In fact, they've coincided with a period of middle class decline. Maybe the iPhone is an overrated gadget. And there are not very many Silicon Valley billionaires who are willing to talk that way. So he's a very interesting character in this whole world that I describe.
Here's another question. Don't you feel the changes in the tax code resulting in significant inequality helped end the ability to achieve the American dream and began this unwinding?
Well, another thing that began in the late 70s was, and of course when Reagan became president, was dramatic, you know, regressive changes in the tax code. Now, maybe there needed to be some changes because taxes on the upper brackets were, what, at 80% during the Eisenhower years? Somehow those were still very prosperous years. The 70s changed everything. I keep coming back to the 70s because suddenly businesses couldn't compete. Globalization began. Inflation ate away at people's wealth and at business wealth. And there was a reaction, which is we have to protect our interests here. And wealthy people did the same. And there was perhaps a natural reaction, which brought Reagan in. What is strange and I think is disturbing is once certain taboos seem to be broken, like the idea that you should not do everything you can if you're a successful company like Apple to pay the least taxes possible and then complain that there are not enough educated engineers in this country, that if you're a CEO who's just fired 20% of the workforce, you should not have a board that is going to give you a big pay raise for doing that. Things that just demoralize people, that make it seem as if you're a sucker if you play by the rules. That shift didn't need to follow the course correction that came in with Reagan, but it seemed as if once it began, there was no stopping it. And once a taboo is broken, everyone has to break it, or else you're the sucker at the poker table. So I think the tax code became kind of a little window or a loophole into which much bigger forces started to pour in.
There has been a movement among many of the very rich people in the Bay Area and across the country to be more philanthropic, and there was the pledge of having billionaires sign up to give money away,
right,
and Warren Buffett's giving a lot of his to Bill Gates to give away. Is that the sign of something, a movement in that direction?
No, that's a sign of the maturing of a
rich person,
of an elite, of a plutocracy, which understands that, first of all, it doesn't kind of look good to die with all your money, and second, that the country needs them. I mean, that there's these desperate needs. But I admire Buffett more for calling for the end of the carried interest exemption than I do for calling for his fellow billionaires to give away half their wealth. That is the kind of structural change, and also, you know, a fundamental like sacrifice of a self-interest that mm-hmm. I think sets a good pattern for others to follow.
So. You paint a bleak picture of politics in Washington and passages of the book. Someone asks, can we trust anyone in government?
Well, I have a positive portrait of Elizabeth Warren at the end mm-hmm. of the book. And the only reason I trust her...
Well, she's only been in office...
She may well disappoint us. You know, it worried me to see her join the least democratic mm-hmm. body in any Western democracy, the U.S. Senate. Mm-hmm. And to know what senators become, because I've interviewed quite a few of them. What I like about her is that she doesn't talk with a kind of wink and a nod mm-hmm. as if to say, we all know that we're in the same group here, and I just need to say these things for my constituents, but basically, you know, we understand each other. Instead, she scares people. She is plain-spoken. She seems actively hostile to the institutions that I think have caused so much damage, especially Wall Street banks. She reminds me of, you know, of my grandfather, George Huddleston, who was a kind of populist congressman from Alabama in the early 20th century. She reminds me of politicians like La Follette.
Mm-hmm. Wisconsin.
She comes from Oklahoma. She's a prairie populist. That's a type of American politician that has pretty much died out. Mm-hmm. But there she is, and so I'm watching her with, you know, a certain amount of hope.
Once something unwinds, as we feel it has, or you feel it has over the last few years, is there any going back? Can we ravel something back together? Can it be wound back up?
Not in the same way. So, you know, can we have the New Deal back? Probably not. Can we have Glass-Steagall back? That was what Jeff Connaughton tried to do. Probably not. Does that mean nothing like a reassertion of public power against all this private power? Can't happen. No. There's a constant shifting back and forth in American history between public interest and private interest. And we have now gone so far in the direction of private interest. I think there is a sense of crisis and of things being broken that we need, that we still need. We need an SEC that can prevent the stock market from becoming an electronic casino that only the wealthiest and most sort of sophisticated investors stand a chance in, because the stock market's an important institution for ordinary Americans to put their money in. But it's become a place where high-frequency trading in milliseconds, you know, is going to win. And you, if you're out there with your 20-year, you know, little stock certificate, you're just not going to, you're going to be left behind. So there's no reason why in some new form the old idea of public power and public accountability can't be revived. But I know my own tendency, which is to look back to the Roosevelt Republic as the model, probably gets in the way of my thinking clearly about the future. We all have our biases, and that's mine. You know, and maybe people younger than me will figure it all out.
Movements bubble up. We had the Occupy Wall Street movement for a little while. It seems to have fizzled out. We had the Tea Party, on the other hand, which is sustaining itself a little longer. Is it going to take something like that, or is that the wrong way to go about
it? No, I think of Occupy and the Tea Party as... they don't have the answers, but they're both from very different poles, and they're both in my book. There's a Tea Party leader in Tampa who's an ordinary housewife who becomes a political leader in Tampa. And then there's a long chapter on Occupy Wall Street. They both are populist reactions to a sense that the elite have failed and the institutions run by those elites no longer serve broader public concerns. And that diagnosis, I think, is accurate and will stay with us because it's accurate. Occupy was a meme more than a movement, but I think it was a really important meme. It gave people a language to kind of articulate a feeling that was very widely held but kind of inchoate. And once the park, and I spent a lot of time at Zuccotti Park, and once it was raided, Occupy ended, which showed it never had a deep foundation. It didn't have a structure. It was against structure. In a way, it was part of the unwinding. It wanted everything to be level with no leaders and no goals and demands. And I don't think in politics that's going to get you very far. But it did, through media today, through new media, articulate something that is real. The Tea Party, you know, I think has more of a basis in local politics and local parties, but it too kind of came and went pretty fast, as things often do in American life. They're both, you know, from a kind of moving in the direction of socialism, moving in the direction of libertarianism, totally different directions. You can't have both. But they both were saying, you know, the center hasn't held. The elites, I mean, one of the main characters among the celebrities is Robert Rubin, sort of a shining example of Wall Street and Washington at their most high-minded, a complete failure in the end because he was getting well-paid by a bank that turned out to require massive infusions of taxpayer money in order to survive and nearly brought down the rest of the economy with it. When people see that, they just think, you know, our meritocracy might actually be rigged. Maybe, you know, maybe there's a sense in which the people who seem to be the most qualified really don't know what they're doing. And I talked to people at both Occupy and the Tea Party who said that very clearly. Mm-hmm. They don't know any better than I do. I don't like that state of affairs. That leads to Sarah Palinism, where know-nothingism and ignorance are exalted. I actually believe in experts. I believe, you know, in institutions that have, you know, you move up as you get better. But I don't believe that they should be fake. I don't think they should be rigged. And I think more and more that's the way it seems.
In your opinion, what are the most important things that we can do collectively and in our individual lives to ensure a just, decent, and equitable America?
That's the question I fear the most.
Wait till you hear the next one.
Uh-oh. Does it get personal? I think I don't have... This book does not end with 10 prescriptions for making America a better place. There are other books that do that. I didn't want to destroy what I had done by leaving you with an inadequate, you know, and kind of bogus set of policy cures. So all I wanted to do was to paint a portrait and to make it as panoramic and intimate as I could at the same time, hoping that narrative is one way that we understand ourselves, one way that we see who we are and how different things that seem to be happening in different dispersed places and have nothing to do with each other, actually there is something holding it together. There is some common story that ties Wall Street to rural North Carolina, to Youngstown, to Silicon Valley, and that's what I've tried to do in The Unwinding, and that's my best inadequate answer to that question.
Why is it that we don't see, maybe it just takes the perspective of time, these things happening in the moment, that we don't recognize at the time what's going wrong and how to stop it from heading in that direction?
Well, because we're too close to it, because it's all around us. It's our life. We come to take things for granted. You become paralyzed if you think critically too much about your life. You have to just live it to some extent. But I think there's a broad sense in America, even if the housing market is now ticking upward and the stock market is actually reaching record levels, there's a broad sense that we haven't had either real economic dynamism or real political progress in this country for a long time. And Americans are restless, and they also have an idea of the country that's beyond just GDP and quarterly earnings and, you know, who won the last cycle. There's something essential in the fabric, and it's on the walls in Dean Price's house in North Carolina. The Declaration is on one wall. The Gettysburg Address is on another wall. And a quote from Robert E. Lee is on the table in the dining room. So he's kind of got it all covered. And
hedging his bets.
It's like that's... He's a believer. I mean, maybe in sophisticated cities, people no longer feel comfortable with those things. For Dean Price, that's what it's about. That's why he's doing what he's doing. He came up to my house along with Tammy Thomas. They actually met and stayed at my house a couple of weeks ago, which was a little bit crazy for me, because suddenly these people came out of my head and were staying in my house. But Dean gave me this little framed quote. It was of the people, by the people, for the people. And it's a perfect Dean Price gift, without irony. Here, George, I know this means something to you.
Well, unfortunately, we have reached the end of our program. Time for one last question from the audience, which is, if you have no suggestions for how to fix things, this is the one I said, what did I say? To whom should we turn, or to what?
I guess the lesson I learned from writing The Unwinding is that when you think nothing is happening, or when you're not paying attention, something is always happening. And it's often in the most unlooked for places, where the media is not there. There's no one paying attention. It's happening while people are focused on the iPhone 6 or on the latest filibuster in the Senate. And that is happening in this book. It's very local. It's very fragmentary. It's very much people organically responding to what they see right at their feet in their own communities and coming up with improvised answers, which shows a certain creativity and resourcefulness and resilience, which to me is hopeful. I don't see it as part of some larger social pattern or trend that I could give a name to. Maybe that's for another writer. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's happening, and it may be sort of the duty of each of us to think about that and to think what it requires, where we stand. It may not come from Washington this time. It might come from each of these little quiet places.
Just like to ask you to let George get to the table out there to sign the books quickly, as opposed to approaching him up here, as we thank George Packer, staff writer for The New Yorker, author of The Unwinding. We also thank our audiences here and on radio and the internet, and I want to remind you he will autograph the book, and it's for sale in the lobby. I'm Doug Sovereign, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.